my thing is, I wanted to, you know, if I'm going to farm, I'm going to farm. I'm not going to farm and do something else. So that had to change. We had to change what we were raising because it wasn't profitable. We had to change how we were raising it. You know, people think I'm crazy because I raise all these different crops. They said, you got to be really busy. I'm actually less stressed than when I was raising three crops.
Welcome to the 362nd installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. When Roy Falzgraf returned to his family's northeastern Colorado grain farm in 2016, he did it with one stipulation. He had to have the opportunity to do things in a way that farming could be a full-time endeavor that benefited the land and the community. Roy is the third generation of Falzgraf to till this soil in a part of the country that can be pretty unforgiving when it comes to weather conditions. The average annual rainfall can be around 14 inches, and in recent years, it's ranged from only 6 inches annually to over 22 inches. Roy jokes that sometimes a year's worth of precipitation seems to come all at once, creating major problems with washing and soil compaction. And the temperature can range from a bone-hard 25 below to a scorching 105 above. That means building resilient soil is critical in this region. Roy knew taking over the farm would be challenging. In fact, he had attempted to come back to the operation once before after graduating from college in 1999, but left due to the lack of profitability and the fact that he lost a lease on some acres. But the second time around, he was committed to taking a different approach. His grandparents and parents had been good stewards of the land by utilizing no-till, for example. But Roy felt steps needed to be taken to build the biology of the soil and make it more resilient in the long term, ecologically and economically. After attending the 2017 Colorado Conservation Tillage Association Conference, Roy got excited about the potential for building the soil's innate ability to generate fertility and manage moisture by growing a diversity of crops on the land. When he took over the operation, its main crops were wheat, corn, and proso millet. In addition, the operation practiced a system that involved periodically leaving certain fields fallow for a year as a way to preserve moisture and fertility. Today, the Falzgraf operation raises as many as 18 different crops in a season, including oats, proso millet, corn, buckwheat, food-grade milo, camelina, dry edible beans, and sunflowers. The Falzgrafs also have 30 beehives and 80 laying hens, and are even experimenting with dryland rice and sesame. They've adjusted their no-till system and tweaked things like row spacing to preserve moisture. One big change is that the farm no longer leaves fields fallow. Instead, the Falzgrafs try to keep living roots in the soil as long as possible throughout the year. They find this helps build biology and soil aggregates while preventing erosion. Roy monitors his soil's health closely, using methods such as the Haney test to measure the impact of various crops and methods on the soil biome. These changes have paid off. Soil organic matter levels have risen, and the fields are much less prone to drought, compaction, and runoff. The Falzgraf's fertilizer and herbicide costs have plummeted, and they've been able to produce profitable yields despite extreme weather events in recent years. These positive changes have made Roy a big believer in the idea that regenerative farming can make agriculture a force for good when it comes to the environment and the community. But he also feels that in order for the general public to learn more about why farmers utilize certain practices, they need to find a way to support these practices through the marketplace. That's why PFZ Farms direct markets value-added items such as gluten-free baking mixes, honey, skincare products, and eggs. In January 2025, Roy was invited by the Land Stewardship Project to share his story during a special small grains workshop in Albert Lea, Minnesota. As part of a three-part series of podcasts focused on the workshop, I talked to Roy over Zoom about how his family has built an operation centered around connecting healthy soil with healthy food. He also shared how he sees a soil-centric approach to agriculture as a way for eaters and farmers to team up and take on a system that currently does not reward a diversified, regenerative approach to food production.
It's really a crapshoot. I mean, in the last 5 years, The least amount of precipitation we've had for a year was 6 inches. The year before that, we had 22 and a half. But that 22 and a half came, it started on April 28th with 9.5 inches in 7 hours. And the rest of the 22 inches came by June 15th. And then it didn't have a, we didn't have a significant rainfall event for the next 18 months. You know, it's so variable and every year is very different. The range of temperatures, we run 25 below. We'll hit 25 below for a couple of days in February. And we can have highs 100 to 105 any month from May through September. But some years we'll hit 100 2 days. And some years we'll have 100 degrees for weeks on end. So it's a really varied climate. Ray Archuleta refers to it as a very fragile climate. When we get rain, our thunderstorms are usually very intense. There's a lot of hail in the area. This last year, our hail storm, we had pea-sized hail and 90-mile-an-hour winds. And there's been hail up to 4 inches in diameter here. So we kind of catch it all. We're very windy. Everybody says they're windy, and I would encourage them to visit Northeast Colorado, and then we'll have a discussion about who's windier. Because we can have 40 to 60 mile an hour sustained winds three to four days at a time, any time of year. So middle of winter, we could have really bad winds. In the middle of summer, we've seen, this last year was in the 90s, and we had 40 to 60 mile an hour winds for three days in a row. So for us, it's capturing the moisture we get and then conserving it however we possibly can. That being said, we have great soils. We're usually a little light on phosphorus, but you know, where I'm at, we're 60% sand and then equally split between clay and loam. So we have soils that really can perform if we have timely rain. We can do dryland corn. If everything hits just right, we could have 150 bushel dryland corn. Most years we're happy to get 50. You kind of aim for, you know, you kind of expect for it to be dry and then hope that you can be flexible enough to respond when you get good moisture. A lot of foliar spraying, a lot of focus on that. Traditionally in our area, we are fallow cropping. So, you know, there's a lot of farmers that still fallow crop. So there'll be like wheat this year and then let the ground lie fallow either with tillage or chemical control for weeds, chem fallow. Some people have moved to a three-year rotation. When I took over the farm in 2016, we were in a three-year fallow rotation. With wheat 1 year, the following year would be corn or sunflowers or millet, you know, in that wheat residue. And then we would be fallow for the following year and then go back to wheat that fall. And that's one of the things that I changed when I came back, because there was some really interesting research done at University of Nebraska Research Station, not too far away from here, that essentially what their research shows is the crop that you produce is pretty much based upon the rainfall you get. Mm-hmm. The fallowing ground, traditionally, they expected you to be able to, their thoughts were you saved the moisture. And what their research shows, it either evaporates due to the wind and the heat, or it percolates because that's, you know, what water, how it recharges aquifers. And so with that, we went to continuous cropping, and that was really helpful because we're feeding the soil on a yearly basis, where before, and we would see it in our organic matters, we went to 100% no-till back in 99, and our organic matter would increase 2 years and then it would drop because we weren't feeding the soil. Now we're with the continuous cropping, we're seeing a continual increase in organic matter. Average organic matter in our area is 0.5% to 1%.
Wow.
In our fields, when we measure it in the top 6 inches, we are running 3.5%, 4%, 4.5%. So we've increased that significantly. And that makes a huge impact in terms of crop resilience as the weather goes through its cycle and gets super dry. Every percent of organic matter in my mind adds about a week that we can go without rainfall. And then when we get rain, our infiltration rates are, you know, they start out at 12 inches an hour. And as the profile fills, a saturated profile, we can move about an inch to an inch and a half of moisture through that profile per hour. The soils can take stuff in and hold it. And that's what we need for our climate.
Is it relatively flat ground?
Of course, I was just up in Washington State last week. We are not the Palouse. I do not understand how those fellas farm up there. It's very impressive what they do. There's some lightly rolling hills. We have some fields that lay pretty flat. And we have a couple of fields. My grandfather did terracing in back in the 80s. And the hills are big enough in those fields that the terraces run into each other. We have about 100 foot of elevation change in a quarter of a mile. And it's a horrible field because it's on a dry creek bottom. And so it's gravel in the bottom and a rock hill on top. And it's one of those pieces of ground that back in the 1880s, when they were breaking things out of sod, they should have just left it alone. Mm-hmm. And everybody would have been better off, but they broke it out of sod, and now we're learning to how to make it perform, and being no-till is about one of the best things that we can do to help that, and then playing around with some other cropping things to see how we can change that and improve that field while we're at it.
Well, speaking of playing around with some different cropping ideas, tell me a little bit about some of the enterprises you got going, what all crops you're raising. It sounds like diversity is real important to you.
Diversity is the most important factor. We don't do livestock. I've been in disagreements with individuals that say you can't do regenerative agriculture without livestock, and you can, but you have to be very intentional about it. When I came back to the farm, we were, you know, the three crops, mainly wheat, corn, and proso millet. Dad had raised sunflowers from 1975, and he quit in 08 or 09 because people always said they were hard on the soil. Come to find out, they're actually one of the best soil builders there are. Back in 2018, we started doing some gluten-free production, and we made the decision in 22 that we were no longer going to produce gluten on the farm. So we no longer raise any wheat. We used to be hard red winter wheat. Hard white winter wheat was kind of our primary crop. We've gotten rid of wheat, so we don't have wheat, rye, barley, or triticale. So the main reason a lot of people raise wheat around here anymore is because of the residue. So for my residue crops, I'm raising a Hollis oat. It's the variety that I raise is Streaker. We've raised it for a couple of years. I've been pretty happy with what we're getting on it. And then also for residue, I direct cut my proso millet. I developed a method for direct cutting proso. So I can use we have a shellborn head, stripper header, because residue is so important to our climate, being able to keep that ground protected from the wind and everything. We've started using a stripper header on grain sorghum. So starting to see kind of some differences in residue with the grain sorghum, and pretty happy with that one. We raised two different types of corn, a standard non-GMO hybrid corn. And this last year, we've started raising an open pollination corn, Minnesota 13, to be exact, for the variety. And interesting enough, in this last year, it yielded as well as our poorest hybrids. We had six different hybrids and test plots. It gave me a lot of hope on that Minnesota 13 because, you know, I'm going to keep reusing my seed and essentially try to develop a variety that is more my soil and my climate related. I figure in 3 to 5 years, I'll have a variety that actually does pretty well in Northeast Colorado. We also raised some buckwheat, an oil seed called Camelina, oil sunflowers. I've been playing around with dryland rice. I haven't gotten a crop yet, but I've got a lot closer this year than I did last year. Just trying to see what we can do in our climate and what we can do with the moisture we get. This next year, we're going to be raising sesame. The challenge on that one is actually going to be time before frost. It needs about 120 days to mature, and it needs to go in with the soils pretty warm. So that one's going to be kind of fun to see how it goes. We do dry edible beans. The primary one is black-eyed peas, a phenomenal hot weather dry crop. Fixes more nitrogen than any other pulse crop that we've ever raised. We've done pinto beans, red beans, navies, black beans. We've tried a number of different dry edibles, and kind of depends upon the year and the what the market's doing to which one of those I decide to go with. I've been as high as 18 different crops in a season. And, you know, this last year, I say 12 because two different kinds of corn that we had to treat separately and be very careful that we didn't cross-contaminate with. This next year, the Milo that I raised this last year was a food-grade white. The previous year, I raised both red and white. This next year, I'll raise red and white because I have a pretty good market for my food-grade white, but I also have developed a separate market for my red that I kind of want to take care of. Oh, and then Proso Millet. I said that one before, but I didn't mention it in my list of crops. And that one is, we're raising it for food-grade, and that's actually the main ingredient in the mixes that we make when we start milling. And then, yeah, from the farm, we also have about 30 beehives. We run about 80 layers because we do direct sales into Denver. We do delivery twice a month into Denver, home delivery. Actually, we've found that it's actually a lot easier for us than doing a pickup location. Occasionally, we'll raise meat birds, but that's, you know, kind of what we're doing on the farm. And then from those farm inputs, we do some honey and beauty products with the beeswax. And we've been milling for about 6 years now. That has slowly been evolving from literally a spare bedroom to this last year. We finished out a building and brought in a lot of Austria. And we're now milling pretty consistently a lot more volume than what we had with the little tabletop mills. The new mill can do in about 15 minutes what the old mills could do in an hour, but the old mills were then overheated, and you had to wait for an hour or two for them to cool down before you could run. Now we're running about 200 pounds an hour. Very significant compared to the 35 pounds we'd get every couple hours before. Yeah.
So, Roy, one of the things you've said is that when you came back to the farm in 2016, which I think was the second time you'd come back to the farm, you kind of did it under the stipulation that things would be done a little differently than they had before. I was wondering if you could talk about what was it that you felt needed to be done differently, or what were you looking at as far as kind of bringing a fresh look to that farm?
My father had milled or had farmed for 40 years, and he was really no better off than he was 40 years ago, other than being 40 years older and, you know, physically and mentally exhausted because of the markets that he sold into, you know, essentially that the churn of the commodity market, mm-hmm. where the price is just enough to almost break even. In a good year, you might make a little bit of money, but your goal was to actually break even. My parents both worked off-farm jobs. My thing is, I wanted to, you know, if I'm going to farm, I'm going to farm. I'm not going to farm and do something else. So that had to change. We had to change what we were raising because it wasn't profitable. We had to change how we were raising it because, you know, my dad did a really good job in taking care of the soil, but he wasn't doing anything to build the soil. That was kind of that stipulation of we need to change what we're doing so we can help the soil out so we can be profitable. Because if we're not taking care of the soil, it's not going to be able to take care of us.
It was kind of being sustained, but it wasn't really being regenerated. Sounds like.
Yeah. You know, because I had originally come back to the farm when I graduated from college in 1999. I had a 5-year lease on a farm, and then that ground got sold out from underneath me. So when that lease was up, the farm couldn't support less my parents. So I went off and did other things, but physically my dad, he just couldn't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the fall of 16, it was one of those, you either come back or we sell out. And I said, well, I'll come back, but we can't do what we're doing. where I'm really lucky is Dad's only rule was you could raise whatever you want as long as you already have a market for it before it goes in the ground, or at least a really good lead or two, you know, preferably contract in hand. That was the rule. And we've had some, you know, pretty rough years in the last couple of years. There's always that concern of making ends meet and getting renewed with the banker. And, you know, he worries about that. But at the same time, he says, we can't change what we're doing because we're doing the right thing. And so he's really bought into kind of focusing on soil health. He sees the difference, you know, when it's 105 and the neighbor's corn is all wilted and looks like a field of pineapples and our corn looks like it's in the mid 80s and, you know, lush and green. There's no question in his mind that soil health is where we need to be focused at, and we need to stay the course.
Well, that was one thing I wanted to ask you was, what were some of the major agronomic changes you made? It sounds like emphasis on soil health was kind of one of the number one things that you was part of that shift.
Yeah, absolutely. When we went to continuous cropping, you know, to keep a living root in the soil, and with our climate and our moisture, we can't, with caveats, we can't have a continuous living root. That being said, I've actually started playing around with using Dutch white clover to integrate into our other crops. I've had limited success. We were great until we hit 6 inches of precip for the year. Mm. And the 38th month old clover died because there just wasn't any water. We don't have enough moisture to do cover cropping. You know, we our moisture timing isn't right. When we harvest our main crop coming off, it's usually the driest, hottest time of the year. So to come in and try to seed a cover crop when it's 105 degrees and there's zero moisture in the top inches, it doesn't make any sense. With that, I started bringing in crops with diversity. We started doing soil health testing back in 17, and then went to the whole farm in 18, looked, you know, started testing every field every year. What I noticed was there are some fields that had a lot better soil health score than others. Some of these fields were literally side by side, and there was a full point difference in soil health score. It's like, what's going on? This is pretty much the same weather, pretty much the same soils. So the difference has to be cropping. And so we built that chart now with some of the other presentation work that I've done. I've actually extended that chart. It actually goes back to 1990 to present. So I can tell you what was in what field in 1984 or 1994. And, you know, it's one of those, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but with that, we were able to determine that sunflowers, which we already knew had a very extensive root system, that extensive root system takes a long time for it to break down. And it actually affects soil health for up to 8 years following the crop. And so it was one of those, okay, well, that tells us we need to have sunflowers in every field at least once every year, 8 years. We started raising some legumes, getting the nitrogen that those fixed. We added buckwheat. The exudates of buckwheat feed a group of soil bacteria that are lithiotrophs, that are Latin for rock eaters, and they convert the rock phosphorus in the soil that's unavailable to plants. They convert it to be in an available form. And the year following buckwheat, we get about a 5 pound per acre bump in phosphorus. It also does the same thing for manganese. And manganese is super important for closing, for the plant respiration, for the plant to be able to close down when it's hot to hold that moisture in. And we've seen that that actually aids in drought tolerance for crops that are following buckwheat. You see that result from that. The manganese is also important for photosynthesis. And with photosynthesis, you know, you increase the rate of photosynthesis, you get better plants, more yield, more, you know, more energy out there. You know, with that, with looking at what we were getting with, we switched over to the Haney test for our soil health test because we believe the Haney test is giving us the most accurate representation of what's out in our fields. I work with Lance Gunderson at Regen Ag Labs for my testing. He is such a great resource that if there's something I can't understand, I call Lance and he can explain it to a to me in a way that I can understand it, at least. He's a phenomenal communicator on soil health tests. So with that, we were able to, you know, reduce our fertilizer rates. Our average fertilizer cost per acre is $17.50. And that's a starter fertilizer. And then we're using AMS, ammonium sulfate, for our nitrogen source, because we need the sulfur more than we need the nitrogen.
How would that compare to your cost before for fertilizer?
The cost before, we would be easily $50 to $60
wow.
an acre. With going to continuous cropping, we get better cover on the fields. We've been able to cut our herbicide rates, our usage at least. We don't cut our rates because we got to stay on label. But, you know, we've reduced our herbicides 75%, depends upon the crop. You know, some crops are starting to have to fight with Palmer amaranth out here. Palmer amaranth is a bugger to battle. We've gotten some grant money to build a different air seeder. Our current air seeder is on 12-inch rows.
Mm-hmm.
I drill everything on 12s right now. So I drill my corn and sunflowers on 12-inch spacing. It works for my climate. Mm-hmm. It actually does help save moisture, even though I increase my plant population. I end up with more moisture. It's counterintuitive, but it works. With that, we got a grant that we're actually taking an old air seeder and rebuilding it to be at 3-inch row spacing to get that really narrow spacing on our cereal grains, particularly the oats and millet. I'd be really interested to see what they're going to do. And with weed suppression, same thing on our dry edible beans. We'll be able to canopy on our dry edible beans in 3 weeks to a month. And getting that canopy out there just really helps slow those weeds down. And Palmer, shading helps. It doesn't take it out, but shading helps. We've ended up, we have a weed zapper that uses electricity to kill weeds. The great part about Palmer amaranth is it's very conductive. And it works very well to kill weeds with that, to kill Palmer with that. But we've made a huge number of changes. And that's the funny thing is I was working on my presentation for the conference that I was at this last week. And I have a slide that lists all the changes that I've made since 2017. And I had to make the font smaller to get them all to fit on the slide. I don't realize that I've made those changes. They just become, you know, second nature. That's just what I'm going to do. And then I look at that list and it's like, wow, there's a reason that everybody thinks I'm really busy all the time. It's because there's a bunch of stuff that I do now that I didn't do. But all of those things just contribute to what's going on in our soil and trying to make it better.
Well, and it sounds like a major change maybe that you made is this emphasis on, hey, we're raising food for people, that food connection to soil health and to diversity is become really key part of your farming enterprises.
You know, the reason that we do direct sales initially was not profitability. I was like 8 years old. My dad was a part-time minister for 30 some years. And there would be people that would come, you know, spend the night at the church. They were traveling across country. And the next day we would, you know, have them out for breakfast and then give them a tour of the farm. There was this one group, it was a youth group that was going to a youth conference, and there was about 30 kids from Pennsylvania and from urban and suburban Pennsylvania. Had them out for breakfast, and then we took them on a tour of the farm, and we took them out and we showed them the cows. And I'm sitting there going, it's a cow. You know, I mean, why are we showing them our cows? We don't have special cows. That's back when we had cattle. They're nothing special. They're just a bunch of cows. One of the kids made the comment he had never seen a cow in real life before. And it was just like, wow, that's kind of crazy. And I said something to Dad, and my dad said the most important job that a farmer has is actually education. Because if the consumer doesn't know what we're doing and why we're doing it, they're not going to support us. When I came back to the farm, it was starting to become really obvious. I mean, on social media and talking about all the evils of herbicides, which they're not the perfect thing, but they're the best solution we got right now kind mm-hmm. of thing. And so at that point, it's like, well, if I'm going to talk to consumers, and tell them why we do what we do, well, we need to have something to sell. That's kind of where we got into our direct sales. And then there's a book called The Biology of Belief by Bruce Lipton. And in there, it talks about something called epigenetics. What epigenetics is essentially, we have a lot of genes in our DNA that are not expressed. And the reason they aren't expressed is because they're not activated. And if we eat really crappy food, well, we're going to activate the genes that get along with that. But if we eat really healthy food, we actually can trigger a different set of genes, and it actually can make us healthier. And it's not only that for humans, but it's for animals. At that point, that's where I really started the mantra of everything you raise is food. It doesn't matter if it's food for people or food for animals, it's food, and we need to treat it that way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if we raise healthier corn, well, then we're going to have healthier beef or chicken or whatever. So we need to treat it all with that same respect that our family will eat that at some point. And so that's really kind of where that kicked off. And then looking at, you know, some of the results, we were part of a grant that they were doing some nutritional studies, and we raised chickpeas and they wanted a sample of those, and we sent them in, and they're like, oh, we'll have results in a month or so. And a month went by and I didn't hear anything. And I finally called them up and they're like, oh, well, the lab had a problem. They're just getting ready to run them again. And a couple of weeks went by and I hadn't heard anything. And I called them again and they said, well, the lab wants to know what you use for fertilizer. Why does the lab want to know what I use for fertilizer? And the lab just wants to know. And it's like, well, it was simple enough that I told them right off the top of my head. It was that year was 17 and a half pounds of a product called 40 Rock, which is a starter with phosphorus, 20 pounds of urea. That's before we started doing AMS. And then at bloom on the chickpeas, we apply a micronutrient called ZMC that helps with pod retention. And it's, you know, really good for pulse crops. Why do they want to know, you know, what I applied? And they said, well, they got the results back and they can't believe the results. And so they want to know why. Mm-hmm. And so they gave me the results with the stipulation that I couldn't publicly share the results. And of course, the study's long over now. And it came back that our results were the nutritional values were six times higher than what standard chickpeas were. That would explain why when we sell it to our customers and they comment, that our dry beans, number one, taste so much better than other dry beans they've had. And they make half as much as they used to because their family doesn't eat as much. They just feel full. And it's like, well, that makes sense. We have healthier soils. There's more nutrition in those. So when you eat them, your body is like, you know what? We've had enough. We don't need any more nutrition. And that's one reason why, you know, when I talk, I always encourage farmers to think that we actually, if we can improve our soils and our nation and increase the nutritional value of our food and our food system, we actually can help cure obesity because people just can't eat the food anymore because they're full. Their body is satisfied. And some people overeat because they're missing something and their body is craving it. So they just continue to eat and eat. And they get calories, but not nutrition. And so that's, you know, where these pieces kind of overlapped and kind of moved us into looking at that nutritional value and kind of looking at what's going on, you know, with our sales and things like that.
So obviously you're farming in a different climate, different soils, even a different marketing infrastructure than maybe what we have here in the upper Midwest. Are there some lessons you've learned over the past several years with your experience with diversifying, focusing on soil health, connecting to that food and that nutrition issue that maybe could be applied no matter where you're farming? I guess, do you have some ideas for somebody who is interested in, as you put it, maybe farming in nature's image and making that closer connection to natural systems and the farming systems out there?
I've talked all over the place about what we're doing on the farm. And I always tell people that you don't copy what I do. The reason is my farm is different than yours. I would tell my neighbor across the road don't copy what I do. I honestly believe that the soil gets to know the farmer. If you're used to one way and then all of a sudden you completely change everything, the soil is going to be like, whoa, what's going on here? And you're going to shock it. And it would be too much, and it would actually not perform well for at least a couple of years. My big thing is I want people to look at what they do, no matter where they're at, and question, why do they actually do it? Are they doing it because it has a benefit? Mm-hmm. Because it's something that's been identified to, you know, improve their profitability, improve the health of their soils? Or are they doing it because that's just what we do? Because if we're doing it because that's what we do, is it really good for us then? I've challenged things on our own farm in terms of seed treatments. Row spacing. I mean, I'm building an air seeder for 3-inch row spacing. I challenged of why are we fertilizing, when we fertilize, and how we fertilize. What, you know, we moving from urea, which is really a salt based fertilizer, to AMS, which doesn't have that salt load. You know, it's like, why do we do this? Do we do this for benefit or not? So it doesn't matter where you farm or how you farm. The key is what is your mindset and how do you think about it? I love talking to people that complain about it being dry and they live in a place where they get 50 inches of rain a year. It's like, let's not talk about dry, but you hear people saying, well, that doesn't work here. Well, have you tried it? And if it doesn't work there, why doesn't it work? Or is there some way you can modify it? You know, I say cover crops don't work in this climate unless you have livestock to graze them. And if you're grazing them, well, you're actually raising diverse forage, which is great for cattle. It's great for the soil, but it's not a cover crop that they're raising like they do back in the Midwest, where they're raising rye over the winter to help dry out the ground so they can actually get in and get the seed in the ground. That if I was farming in that climate, absolutely, I would love to have 6-foot tall cereal rye that I have to roll down before I go plant or plant green into it. I've tried to plant green. It did not end well. But the big thing is why do you do what you do? And is it the best thing for your soil, for your farm, for yourself? You know, people think I'm crazy because I raise all these different crops. They said, you got to be really busy. I'm actually less stressed than when I was raising 3 crops. The reason is, instead of having to harvest or seed 700 acres in a week, the most I do now is 400 acres in a week. And I can do that with the equipment we have. I don't have to hire someone else to get it done. That diversity makes my mental health better. And so why are we doing what we do? Is it best for us? And that is the piece that people can apply no matter what their climate is or where they're at. The other, I guess, kind of enterprise that we've started. My partner, Emily, she and I met at a Nicole Masters class that was about helping farmers deal with change. She's passionate. She was a massage therapist and worked with people in trauma and stuff for 25 years. And she had people that she worked with that they weren't getting any better, and she couldn't figure out why. And finally, she determined it was nutrition. So she started looking at the food system. And with what I'm doing, that's how we ended up at a class together. And when we started working together on things, I have a marketing workbook that essentially is a workbook for farmers to work their way through to figure out what they can do differently for marketing. And then Emily and I have developed an online community that farmers can join to support each other and get help. I have raised so many different crops where the closest they had previously been raised is over 500 miles away. And I raise it for a couple of years, and then I figure out, oh, I need to do this. And you talk to someone who's raised it before, and they're like, oh, you need to do this. And it's like, yeah, it took me 3 years to figure that out.
Yeah.
But to be able to be part of a community where farmers are helping each other raise that crop, because in the end, if a farmer goes out of business, they're not going to close the Chicago Board of Trade. So our competition isn't the neighbor. Our competition is the system. And if we work together, with our neighbors or with neighbors in another state with other like-minded farmers, that we can help each other be better off, that we can learn how to do direct sales, that we can actually start making an impact on the food system. It'll feed back. It'll improve our bottom line. It'll be more opportunities for our kids to come back to the farm. Because right now, the biggest export that rural communities have is our children. And we need to give them opportunities. My kids, they might not want to farm, but they might be interested in running a mill. For them to have that chance, I want other farmers to learn how to do that. And through that, we're providing those opportunities for people to help each other be better off. That's, in the end, why we're actually doing all of this, is to help people be healthier physically and mentally. And that's everybody, not just the consumers of the food, but the people that grow it.
For more on how community-based food systems, based on a diversified agriculture, can support rural economies while building soil health, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 362 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.